A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Random House Audio presents Star Wars Outbound Flight by Timothy Zahn. Read for you by Jonathan Davis. Through space, silver gray against the blackness, the light of the distant stars reflecting from its hull.
Hang on!
Dubrak Kento barked over the straining roar of the engines.
Here he comes again!
Clenching his teeth firmly together to keep them from chattering, Georges Cardass got a grip on his seat's armrest with one hand as he finished punching coordinates into the nav computer with the other. Just in time. The Bargain Hunter jinked hard to the left as a pair of brilliant green blaster bolts burned past the bridge canopy.
Cardass!
Kento called.
Snap it up, kid!
I'm snapping!
Cardass called back, resisting the urge to point out that the outmoded nav equipment was Kento's property, not his.
Can't we just talk to them?
Terrific idea, Kento bit out. Be sure to compliment Proga on his fairness and sound business sense. That always works on huts.
The last word was punctuated by another cluster of blaster shots. This group closer than the last.
Rack! The engines can't hold this speed forever!
Maris Ferrazzi warned from the co-pilot seat, her dark hair flashing with green highlights every time a shot went past.
Doesn't have to be forever,
Kento said with a grunt.
Just till we have some numbers. Cardass!
On Cardass's board, a light winked on.
Ready!
He called, punching the numbers over to the pilot station.
It's not a very long jump, though!
He was cut off by a screech from somewhere aft, and the flashing blaster bolts were replaced by flashing star lines as the Bargain Hunter shot into hyperspace. Cardass took a deep breath, let it out silently. This is not what I signed up for, he muttered to himself. Barely 6 standard months after signing on with Kento and Maris, this was already the second time they had to run for their lives from someone. And this time, it was a hut they'd frizzled. Kento, he thought darkly, had a genuine talent for picking his fights.
You okay, Georges?
Cardass looked up, blinking away a drop of sweat that had somehow found its way into his eye. Maris was swiveled around in her chair, looking back at him with concern.
I'm fine, he said,
wincing at the quavering in his voice.
Of course he is,
Kento assured Maris as he also turned around to look at their junior crewer.
Those shots never even got close.
The star lines collapsed back into stars, and Cardass keyed for a full sensor scan, and jerked as a salvo of blaster shot sizzled past the canopy. Kento barked a short expletive.
What the frizz?
He followed us,
Maris said, sounding stunned.
And he's got the range,
Kento snarled, as he threw the Bargain Hunter into another series of stomach-twisting evasive maneuvers.
Cardass, get us out of here! Trying!
Cardass called back, fighting to read the computer displays as they bounced and wobbled in front of his eyes. There was no way it was going to calculate the next jump before even Kento's luck ran out, and the fuming hut back there finally connected. But if Cardass couldn't find a place for them to go, maybe he could find all the places for them not to go. The sky directly ahead was full of stars, but there was plenty of empty black between them. Picking the biggest of the gaps, he punched the vector into the computer.
Try this one,
he called, keying it to Kento.
What do you mean, try?
Maris asked. The freighter rocked, as a pair of shots caught it squarely on the aft deflector.
Never mind,
Kento said, before Cardass could answer. He punched the board, and once again, the star lines lanced out and faded into the blotchy hyperspace sky. Maris exhaled in a huff. That was too close. Okay, so maybe he is mad at us, Kento conceded. Now, like Maris said, kid, what do you mean, try this one?
I didn't have time to calculate a proper jump, Cardass explained, so I just aimed us into an empty spot with no stars.
Kento swiveled around. You mean an empty spot with no visible stars? He asked ominously. An empty spot with no collapsed stars, or pre-star dark masses, or something hidden behind dust clouds? That kind of empty spot?
He waved a hand toward the canopy,
and out toward the unknown regions on top of it.
We don't have enough data in that direction for him to have done a proper calculation anyway, Maris said, coming unexpectedly to Cardass's defense.
That's not the point, Kento insisted.
No, the point is that he got us away from Proga, Maris said. I think that deserves at least a thank you.
Kento rolled his eyes. Thank you, he said. Such thanks to be rescinded if and when we run through a star you didn't see, of course.
I think it's more likely the hyperdrive will blow up first, Cardass warned. Remember that nullifier problem I told you about? I think it's getting...
He was cut off by a wailing sound from beneath them, and with a lurch, the bargain hunter leapt forward like a jiffa on a scent. Running hot! Kento shouted, spinning back to his board.
Maris! Shut her down!
Trying!
Maris called back over the wailing as her fingers danced across her board.
Control lines are looping! Can't get a signal through!
It took Kento over 4 hours to find a way to shut down the runaway hyperdrive without slagging it. During that time, Cardass offered his help 3 times, and Maris offered hers 2. All the offers were summarily refused. Sometime during the first hour, as near as Cardass could figure from the readings tumbling across the displays, they left the relatively well-known territory of the Outer Rim, passing into a shallow section of the far less well-known territory known as Wild Space. Sometime early in the 4th hour, they left even that behind and crossed the hazy line into the unknown regions. At which point, where they were, or what exactly they were flying into, was anyone's guess. But at last the wailing faded away, and a few minutes later, the hyperspace sky collapsed into star lines and then into stars.
Maris!
Kento's voice called from the comm panel.
We're out, she confirmed. Running a location check now.
I'll be right there,
Kento said.
Wherever we are, we're a long way from home, Cardass murmured.
The computer was still sifting data when Kento reappeared on the bridge. Cardass had made sure to be back at his own station by then.
Nice cluster,
the big man commented as he dropped into his seat.
Any systems nearby?
Closest one's about 1/4 light-year directly ahead, Maris said, pointing.
Kento grunted and punched at his board.
Let's see if we can make it, he said.
There was a screech, more genteel than the sound from the bargain hunter's main hyperdrive, and the stars stretched out into star lines. Silently, Cardass counted off the seconds to himself, fully expecting the backup hyperdrive to crash at any time. But it didn't, and after a few tense minutes, the star lines collapsed again to reveal a small yellow sun directly ahead.
There we go,
Kento said approvingly.
All the comforts of home. You figure out yet where we are, Maris?
Computer's still working on it, Maris said. But it looks like we're about 250 light years into unknown space.
There was a twitter from the comm.
We're being hailed,
Cardass reported, frowning as he keyed it on. He threw a look at the visual displays, searching for their unknown caller, and felt his whole body go rigid.
Kento!
He snapped.
It's...
He was cut off by a deep rumbling chuckle from the comm.
So, Dubrak Kento.
An all-too-familiar voice rumbled in Huttese.
You think to escape me so easily?
You call that easy?
Kento muttered as he keyed his transmitter.
Oh, hi, Proga. Look, like I told you before, I can't let you have these furs. I've already contracted with Drixo.
Ignore the furs. Show me your hidden treasure hoard.
Kento frowned at Maris. My what?
Do not play the fool.
Kento muted the transmitter. Cardass, where is he? 100 kilometers off the starboard bow, Cardass told him. And he's coming up fast. A light flashed on Cardass's proximity sensor. Incoming! He snapped, his eyes darting back and forth among the displays as he searched for the source of the attack.
Where?
Kento snapped back. Cardass had it now. Coming from directly beneath the Bargain Hunter, a long, dark missile, arrowing straight toward them.
There!
He said, pointing a finger straight down as he stared at the display. It was only then that his brain caught up with the fact that this wasn't the vector a missile would take from the approaching Hutt ship. He was opening his mouth to point that out when the missile burst open, its nose ejecting a wad of some kind of material. The wad began to expand as it cleared the shards of its container, opening like a fast-blooming flower into a filmy wall stretching over a kilometer across.
Power off!
Kento snapped, lunging across his board to the row of master power switches.
Hurry!
What is it? Cardass asked, grabbing for his board's own set of cutoffs.
A Kana net,
or something like it. Kento gritted out. Status lights were winking red and going out now as the three of them raced against the incoming net. The net won. Cardass had made it through barely 2/3 of his switches when the rippling edges came into sight around the sides of the hull. They folded themselves inward, curling around toward the bridge.
Close your eyes,
Maris warned. Cardass squeezed his eyes shut. Even through the lids, he saw a hint of the brilliant flash as the net dumped its high-voltage current into and through the ship, sending a brief coronal tingling across his skin. And when he carefully opened his eyes again, every light that had still been glowing across the bridge had gone dark. The Bargain Hunter was dead. Through the canopy came a flicker of light from the direction of the Hutt ship.
Looks like they got Proga, too,
he said, his voice sounding unnaturally loud in the sudden silence.
I doubt it, Kento rumbled. His ship's big enough to have cap drains and other stuff to protect him from tricks like this.
A multiple blaze of green blaster fire erupted from the direction of the Hutt ship. It was answered by brilliant blue flashes vectoring in from three different directions, fired from ships too small or too dark to see at the Bargain Hunter's range.
You think whoever this is might get so busy with Proga that they'll forget about us?
Maris asked hopefully.
I don't think so,
Cardass said, gesturing out the canopy of the small gray spacecraft that had taken a position with its nose pointed at the freighter's portside flank. It was about the size of a shuttle or heavy fighter, built in a curved, flowing design of a sort he'd never seen before. They've left us a guard.
Figures,
Kento said, glancing once at the alien ship and then turning back to the green and blue flashes.
50 says Proga lasts at least 15 minutes and takes one of his attackers with him.
Neither of the others took him up on the bet. Cardass watched the fight, wishing he had his sensors back. He'd read a little about space battle tactics in school, but the attacker's methodology didn't seem to fit with anything he could remember. He was still trying to figure it out, when with a final salvo of blue light, it was over.
6 minutes,
Kento said, his voice grim. Whoever these guys are, they're good. The victors took their time poking or prodding or gloating over whatever was left of the Hutt ship. From the number of maneuvering drives Cardass could see winking on and off, he guessed there were just the three ships that had been involved in the battle itself, plus the one still standing watchful guard off their flank. Connor nets, like ion cannons, were designed to disable and hold rather than destroy, and Kento and Maris had most of the systems back online by the time their keeper finally made its move.
Kento, he's shifting position,
Cardass called into the comm, watching as the gray ship drifted leisurely past the canopy and settled into a new spot with the stern above and in front of the bargain hunter's bow. Looks like he's setting up for us to follow him.
On our way, Kento called back. Run the drive up to quarter power.
The gray ship was starting to pull away when he and Maris returned.
There we go,
Kento muttered, dropping into his seat and easing them forward.
Any idea where we're going?
The rest of the group still over by the hut ship, Cardass said, squeezing carefully past Maris as he headed back to his own station. Maybe he's taking us there.
Yeah, looks like it,
Kento agreed as he fed more power to the drive. There were indeed three alien vessels hovering around the remains of Proga's ship when they arrived. Two were duplicates of their fighter-sized escort, while the third was considerably larger.
Looks like they're opening a docking bay for us, Maris said.
Cardass measured the opening port cover with his eyes.
Not much room in there.
Our bow will fit, Kento assured him. We can use the forward service tube to get out.
Their escort led them to the larger ship's side, and 2 minutes later, Kento had the bargain hunter's bow snugged securely inside the docking collar. A boarding tunnel began extending itself toward the service hatch, as Kento shifted the systems to standby. And by the time the three of them had made it down the ladder, the exit sensors indicated the tunnel was in place and pressurized.
Here we go, Kento muttered, drawing himself up to his full height and keying the release.
Let May do the talking.
Two of the crew were waiting outside the hatch as it slid open. Blue-skinned humanoids, with glowing red eyes and blue-black hair, dressed in identical black uniforms sporting green shoulder patches. Each of them had a small but nasty-looking handgun belted at his waist.
Hello? Kento greeted them as he took a step into the tunnel. I'm Dubrak Kento, captain of the Bargain Hunter.
The aliens didn't answer, but merely moved to either side and gestured down the tunnel.
This way?
Kento asked, pointing with one hand as he took Maris' arm with the other.
Sure.
He and Maris headed down the tunnel, the ribbed material of the floor bouncing like a swinging bridge with each step. Cardass followed close behind them, studying the aliens out of the corner of his eye as he passed between them. Aside from the unusual skin color and those glowing eyes, they were remarkably human-looking. Some offshoot of humanity's ancient expansion into the galaxy? Or were they their own people, with the resemblance purely coincidental? Two more aliens were waiting just inside the ship proper, dressed and armed the same way as the first pair, except that their shoulder patches were yellow and blue instead of green. They turned in military precision as the three humans arrived and led the way down a smoothly curved corridor made of a pearl-like material with a soft, muted sheen. Cardass ran his fingertips gently along the wall as they walked, trying to decide whether it was metal, ceramic, or some kind of composite. 5 meters down the corridor, their guides came to a halt outside an open doorway and planted themselves on either side.
In there, huh? Kento asked.
Sure.
The room was small and simple, its furnishings consisting of a table and half a dozen chairs. A conference room, Cardass tentatively identified it, or possibly a duty crew meal room. Another of the blue-skinned aliens was seated on the far side of the table, his glowing eyes steady on his visitors. He wore the same black as their escorts, but with a larger burgundy patch on his shoulder and a pair of elaborately tooled silver bars on his collar. An officer.
Hello,
Kento said cheerfully, coming to a stop at the edge of the table.
I'm Dubrak Kento, captain of the Bargain Hunter. I don't suppose you happen to speak basic?
The alien didn't reply, but Cardass thought he saw his eyebrow twitch slightly.
Maybe we should try one of the Outer Rim trade languages, he offered.
Thanks for that brilliant suggestion,
Kento said with a touch of sarcasm.
Greetings to you, noble sir,
he continued, switching to Cybisti.
We're travelers and traders from a far world, who mean no harm to you or your people.
Again, there was no response.
You could try Ta'aja,
Maris said.
I don't know Ta'aja very well,
Kento said, still in Cybisti.
Cybisti will do, the alien behind the table said calmly in that language.
Kento turned back, blinking in surprise.
Did you just say?
I said, Cybisti will do, the alien repeated. Please, be seated.
Thank you,
Kento said, pulling out chairs for himself and Maris, and nodding to Kardas to do likewise.
I'm Commander Mithron Yuru-Odo of the Chiss Ascendancy. This is the Springhawk, Picket Force 2 command vessel of the Expansionary Defense Fleet. And you are?
Mithron Yuru-Odo asked, shifting his glowing red eyes to Kardas. Kardas opened his mouth.
I'm Dubrak Kento, Commander.
Kento put in before he could speak.
Captain of the...
And you are?
Mithron Yuru-Odo repeated, his eyes still on Kardas, a slight but noticeable emphasis on the pronoun. Kardas looked sideways at Kento, got a microscopic nod.
I'm Georges Kardas, he said, crewer on the freighter Bargain Hunter.
And these?
Mithron Yuru-Odo asked, gesturing to the others. Again, Kardas looked at Kento. The other's expression had gone rather sour, but he nevertheless gave his junior crewer another small nod.
This is my captain, Dubrak Kento, Kardas told the commander. And his,
girlfriend? Co-pilot? Partner? How shall I put this, thought Kardas.
His second in command, Maris Ferasi, Kardas said.
Mithron Yuru-Odo nodded to each in turn, then turned back to Kardas.
Why are you here?
We're Corellian traders, from one of the systems in the Galactic Republic, Kardas said.
Corellian,
Mithron Yuru-Odo said, as if trying out the word.
And the other vessel?
Pirates of some sort,
Kento put in before Kardas could answer.
Did you know these pirates?
Mithron Yuru-Odo asked.
How could we possibly?
Kento began.
Yes, we've had trouble with them before,
Kardas interrupted. There'd been something in Mithron Yuru-Odo's voice as he asked that question.
I think they were gunning specifically for us.
You must be carrying a valuable cargo.
It's nothing fancy,
Kento said, shooting a warning look at Kardas.
A shipment of furs and exotic luxury garments. We're most grateful to you for coming to our aid.
Kardas felt his throat tighten. The bulk of their cargo was indeed luxury clothing, but sewn into the filigree collar of one of the furs was an assortment of smuggled fire gems. If Mithron Yuru-Odo decided to search the shipment and found them, there was going to be a very unhappy Drixo the Hutt in the Bargain Hunter's future.
You're welcome, Mithron Yuru-Odo said. I'd be curious to see what your people consider luxury garments. Perhaps you'll show me your cargo before you leave.
I'd be delighted, Kento said. Does that mean you're releasing us?
Soon, Mithron Yuru-Odo assured him. First I need to examine your vessel and confirm that you're indeed the innocent travelers you claim.
Of course, Kento said easily. We'll give you a complete tour anytime you want.
Thank you, Mithron Yuru-Odo said. But that can wait until we reach my base. Until then, resting quarters have been prepared for you. Perhaps later you'll permit me to show you Chiss hospitality.
We would be both grateful and honored, Commander, Kento said, inclining his head in a small bow. I'd just like to mention, though, that we're on a very tight schedule, which our unexpected detour has made that much tighter. We'd appreciate it if you could send us on our way as quickly as possible.
Of course, Mithron Yuru-Odo said. The base isn't far.
Is it in this system?
Kento asked. He lifted a hand before the Chiss could answer.
Sorry, none of my business.
True, Mithron Yuru-Odo agreed. However, it will do no harm to tell you that it's in a different system entirely.
Ah, Kento said. May I ask when we'll be leaving to go there?
We've already left, Mithron Yuru-Odo said mildly.
We made the jump to hyperspace approximately 4 standard minutes ago.
Kento frowned.
Really? I didn't hear or feel anything.
Perhaps our hyperdrive systems are superior to yours,
Mithron Yoruido said, standing up.
Now, if you'll follow me, I'll escort you to the resting area.
He led the way another 5 meters down the corridor to another door, where he touched a striped panel on the wall.
I'll send word when I want you again, he said as the door slid open.
We'll look forward to further conversation,
Kento said, giving a truncated bow as he eased Maris behind him through the doorway.
Thank you, Commander.
The two of them disappeared inside. Inclining his head to the commander, Cardass followed. The room was compactly furnished, containing a 3-tier bunk bed against one wall and a fold-down table and bench seats on the other. Beside the bunk bed were 3 large drawers built into the wall, while to the right was a door leading into what seemed to be a compact refresher station.
What do you think he's going to do with us?
Maris murmured, looking around.
He'll let us go,
Kento assured her, glancing into the refresher station and then sitting down on the lowest cot, hunching forward to keep from bumping his head on the one above it.
The real question is whether we'll be taking the fire gems with us.
Crossing to the other side of the room, Cardass folded down the table and one of the bench seats and sat down, wedging himself more or less comfortably between the table and the wall. Putting his elbow on the table and propping his head up on his hand, he closed his eyes and tried to relax. He didn't realize he'd dozed off until a sudden buzz startled him awake. He jumped up as the door opened to reveal a single black-clad Chiss.
Commander Mithron Yoruido's respects, the alien said, the Cybisti words coming out thickly accented. He requests your presence in forward visual 1.
Wonderful, Kento said, swinging his legs onto the floor and standing up.
Not you, the Chiss said. He gestured to Cardass. This one only.
Kento came to an abrupt halt.
What? It's okay,
Cardass interrupted hastily. The Chiss standing in the doorway hadn't moved, but Cardass had caught a subtle shift of light and shadow that indicated there were others wandering around out there.
I'll be fine. Cardass.
It's okay, Cardass repeated, stepping to the doorway. The Chiss moved back, and he walked out into the corridor. There were indeed more Chiss waiting by the door, 2 of them on either side.
Follow,
the messenger said as the door closed. The group headed down the curved corridor, passing 3 cross corridors and several other doorways along the way. 2 of the doors were open, and Cardass couldn't resist a furtive glance inside each as he passed. All he could see, though, was unrecognizable equipment and more black-clad Chiss. He had expected forward visual to be a crowded high-tech room. To his surprise, the door opened into something that looked like a compact version of a Starliner's observation gallery. A long, curved couch sat in front of a convex floor-to-ceiling viewport, currently showing a spectacular view of the glowing hyperspace sky as it flowed past the ship. The room's own lights were dimmed, making the display that much more impressive.
Welcome, Georges Cardass.
Cardass looked around. Mithron Yoruido was seated alone at the far end of the couch, silhouetted against the hyperspace sky.
Please, be seated.
Thank you,
Cardass said, easing himself onto the couch, a cautious meter away from the other.
May I ask why you sent for me?
To share this view, of course,
Mithron Yoruido said dryly,
and to answer a few questions. What exactly is your business, Georges Cardass?
Captain Kento's already told you that,
Cardass said, feeling sweat breaking out on his forehead.
We're merchants and traders.
Mithron Yoruido shook his head.
Unfortunately for your captain's assertions, I'm familiar with the economics of star travel. Your vessel is far too small for any standard cargo to cover even normal operating expenses, let alone emergency repair work. I therefore conclude that you have a sideline occupation.
You haven't the weaponry to be pirates or privateers, so you must be smugglers.
Cardass hesitated. We are mostly just traders, as Captain Kento said, but we sometimes do a little smuggling on the side.
I see, Mithron Yoruido said. I appreciate your honesty, Georges Cardass.
You can just call me Cardass. In our culture, the first name is reserved for use by friends.
You don't consider me a friend?
Do you consider me one? Cardass countered.
Mithron Yoruido merely lifted an eyebrow. No, not yet.
Perhaps someday.
You intrigue me, Cardass. Here you sit, captured by unfamiliar beings a long way from home. Yet instead of wrapping yourself within a blanket of fear or anger, you instead stretch outside yourself with curiosity.
Cardass frowned. Curiosity?
You studied my warriors as you were brought aboard, Mithron Yoruido said. I could see it in your eyes and face as you observed and thought and evaluated. You did the same as you were taken to your quarters, and again, as you were brought here just now.
I was just looking around, Cardass assured him. I didn't mean anything by it.
Calm yourself, Mithron Yoruido said, some amusement creeping into his voice. I'm not accusing you of spying. I, too, have the gift of curiosity, and therefore prize it in others.
Tell me, who is to receive the hidden gemstones? Cardass jerked. You found? I mean, in that case, why did you ask me about it?
As I said, I appreciate honesty, Mithron Yoruido said. Who is the intended recipient?
A group of huts operating out of the Kamra system, Cardass told him, giving up.
Rivals to the ones you... the ones who were attacking us.
He hesitated.
You did know they weren't just random pirates, didn't you?
That they were hunting us specifically?
We monitored your transmissions as we positioned ourselves to intervene, Mithron Yoruido said. Though the conversation was, of course, unintelligible to us, I remembered hearing the phonemes Dubra Kento in the hut speech, when Captain Kento later identified himself. The conclusion was obvious.
A shiver ran up Cardass's back. A conversation in an alien language, and yet Mithron Yoruido had been able to memorize enough of it to extract Kento's name from the gibberish. What kind of creatures were these Chiss, anyway?
What would be the consequences if you didn't deliver the gemstones?
Cardass felt his throat tighten. They'd kill us, he said bluntly.
And if the delivery is merely late?
Cardass frowned, trying to read the other's expression in the flickering hyperspace glow.
What exactly do you want from me, Commander Mithron Yoruido? Nothing too burdensome, Mithron Yoruido said. I merely wish your company for a time.
Why?
Partly to learn about your people, Mithron Yoruido said, but primarily so that you may teach me your language.
Cardass blinked. Our language? You mean basic?
That is the chief language of your republic, is it not?
And what would we get out of it? Cardass asked.
For you, there would be an equal satisfaction of your own curiosity. Mithron Yoruido lifted his eyebrows. You do wish to know more about my people, don't you?
Very much, Cardass said. But I can't see that appealing to Captain Kento.
Perhaps a few extra valuables added to his cargo, then, Mithron Yoruido suggested. That might also help mollify your clients.
Yes, they'll definitely need some mollifying, Cardass agreed grimly. A little extra loot would go a long way toward that.
Then it's agreed, Mithron Yoruido said, standing up.
One more thing, Cardass said, scrambling to his feet. I'll be happy to teach you basic, but I'd also like some language lessons myself.
Would you be willing in turn to teach me the Chiss language? Or to have one of your people do so?
I can teach you to understand, Chiun, Mithron Yoruido said. But I doubt you'll ever be able to properly speak it.
I've noticed you don't even pronounce my name very well.
Kardas felt his face warm.
I'm sorry.
No apology needed,
Mithron Yoruido assured him.
Your vocal mechanism is close to ours, but there are clearly some differences. However, I believe I could teach you to speak Minisiat. It's a trade language widely used in the regions around our territory.
That would be wonderful, Kardas said.
Thank you, Commander Commander. As I said, Chiyun pronunciation is difficult for you,
Mithron Yoruido noted dryly.
Perhaps it would be easier if you called me by my core name, Thrawn.
The receptionist set down her comlink and smiled up at the man and woman standing over her.
The Supreme Chancellor will see you now, Master Sabaoth, she said.
Thank you. Jedi Master Joris Sabaoth said, his voice cool and brooding. Beside him, Lorana Jinsler winced to herself. Her master was angry, and under the circumstances, she couldn't really blame him. But Sabaoth's quarrel was with Palpatine, not a lowly receptionist who had no power or authority over the orders that issued from the Supreme Chancellor's office. There was no reason to vent his annoyance at her. That wasn't the way Sabaoth did things, however. Without another word, he strode away from the woman's desk and headed for the doors to Palpatine's inner office. Lingering half a step behind him, Lorana made sure to catch the receptionist's eye and give her an encouraging smile before following. Supreme Chancellor Palpatine was seated at his desk, an expansive view of Coruscant's skyline visible through the wide window behind him. A young man wearing a tooled tunican and vest was standing beside him, leaning over the desk with a data pad and speaking in a low voice. Palpatine looked up as Sabaoth and Lorana entered, his face breaking into one of his famous smiles.
Ah, Master Sabaoth, he said, gesturing them forward. And your young Padawan, of course. Lorana Jinsler, isn't it? Welcome to you both.
Let's dispense with the pleasantries, Chancellor, Sabaoth said stiffly, pulling a data pad from his belt pouch as he strode forward. This isn't a social visit.
The young man beside Palpatine straightened up, his eyes flashing.
You will not speak to the Supreme Chancellor in that tone, he said firmly.
Mind your tongue, underling, Sabaoth growled. Take your bureaucratic trivia and get out.
The young man didn't budge.
You will not speak to the Supreme Chancellor in that tone.
It's all right, Kinman,
Palpatine said soothingly, holding out a restraining hand to the young man as he rose to his feet.
I'm sure Master Sabaoth doesn't mean any disrespect.
For a moment, Sabaoth and Palpatine stared at each other across the wide expanse of the desk, an almost visible tension rippling the air between them. Then, to Lorana's relief, the Jedi Master's lip twitched.
No, of course not, he said, in a marginally more courteous voice.
As I said, Palpatine said, smiling fondly at the young man. You haven't met my new assistant and advisor, have you, Master Sabaoth? This is Kinmen Doriana.
Pleased and honored,
Sabaoth said in a tone that made it clear he was neither.
As am I, Master Sabaoth, Doriana replied. It's always a privilege to meet one of those who've dedicated their lives to safeguarding the Republic.
As it is for me as well, Palpatine agreed. What can I do for you, Master Sabaoth?
You know very well what you can do for me, Sabaoth growled.
In a word, outbound flight.
Naturally, Palpatine said tiredly, gesturing Lorana to the chair beside Sabaoth as he reseated himself in his own chair.
What is it now?
This.
Waving a hand, Sabaoth used the Force to send the data pad sliding across the desk to stop in front of the Supreme Chancellor.
The Senate Appropriations Committee has cut my funding again.
Palpatine sighed. What do you want me to say, Master Sabaoth?
I can't dictate to the Senate what it should do. I certainly can't force a stiff-necked group like Appropriations to see things our way.
Our way?
Sabaoth echoed. It's our way now, is it? I seem to remember a time not very long ago when you weren't at all enthusiastic about this whole project. Perhaps you should examine your memory more closely, Palpatine said. It's the Jedi Council, not me, that's been backing away from outbound flight for the past few months. I've done everything in my power to assist you. You have your ships, 6 brand new dreadnoughts straight off the Rendili Star Drive assembly line. You have the central storage core you wanted, and the turbolift pylons ready to connect the whole thing together. You have the crews and passengers in training on Yaga Minor.
Ah!
Sabaoth interrupted, jabbing a finger at the datapad still sitting untouched in front of the Supreme Chancellor. In fact, I do not have my passengers, not at all. Some idiot bureaucrat has changed the population profile to consist of crews only, with no families or other potential colonists. Reluctantly, Lorana thought, Palpatine picked up the datapad. A cost-saving decision, most likely, he said, scrolling through the data. Having all those extra people aboard would mean more supplies and equipment.
What it would mean is a cancellation of the entire project,
Sabaoth countered. What sense does it make to send an expedition to another galaxy if there's no chance of planting any colonies once we're there?
Perhaps that's the committee's point, Palpatine suggested quietly. The political situation has changed considerably since you and the Council first proposed this project.
Which is what makes outbound flight all the more important,
Sabaoth said.
We need to find out what dangers or threats might be lurking out in the unknown regions, or poised to invade us from another galaxy.
Dangers? Palpatine echoed, lifting his eyebrows. I was under the impression that outbound flight's purpose was to search for new life and potential force users outside our borders. Certainly, that was the rationale given in the original proposal.
There's no reason it can't do both, Sabaoth said stubbornly. For that matter, I would think adding a security angle to the mission would make it more acceptable to the Senate, not less.
The door closed behind the two Jedi, and for a moment, Kinmon Doriana gazed at the spot where they'd exited, a sour taste in his mouth. As a general rule, nearly all Jedi struck him as pompous and arrogant, and obscenely sure of themselves. But even with that head start, Jor Sabaoth was in a class by himself.
You really don't like him, do you? Palpatine asked mildly.
Setting his expression carefully back to neutral, Doriana shifted his attention back to the Chancellor.
I'm sorry, sir. I just think that, with all the other problems facing the Republic, a massive exploration and colonization project should be relegated to the bottom third of the priority list. And for Master Sabaoth to insist that you personally do something about it...
Patience, Kinmon. Palpatine interrupted soothingly. You must learn to permit people their passions. Outbound flight is Master Sabaoth's.
He looked across the office toward the door.
Besides, even if they find nothing of real value out there, it may be that just the news of their expedition will spark the imaginations of people across the Republic.
If they ever do actually announce it, Doriana said. The last I heard, the Jedi Council still had the whole project wrapped in secrecy.
Palpatine shrugged.
I'm sure they have their reasons.
Perhaps, Doriana hesitated. But I'd like to apologize to you, sir, for speaking out of turn during the meeting.
Don't concern yourself about it, Palpatine assured him. You may go now, Kinmon. There's nothing more I need from you for the rest of the day. I need a chance to consider how I'm going to persuade the Appropriations Committee to restore outbound flight's funding.
As well as find a way to persuade the Council to give Master Sabaoth all the Jedi he wants?
That one I can do nothing about, Palpatine said. If Sabaoth wants more Jedi, he's the one who'll have to persuade Yoda and Windu.
It was a 20-minute air taxi ride to Doriana's home in the Third Ring apartment towers, northeast of the Senate complex. The taxi led him out on the 248th floor landing pad,
and he rode the turbo lift 10 stories down to his apartment. Unlocking the door, he went in, locking and privacy sealing it behind him. He went to a desk in a corner and sat down. From behind the false back in the bottom right-hand drawer, he took a holo projector and plugged it into the computer. The access security code was a simple matter of 12 letters and 18 digits. Punching them in, he picked up his data pad again and settled back to wait. As usual, the wait wasn't very long. Barely 3 minutes after he sent the call, the hooded face of Darth Sidious shimmered into view above the holoprojector.
"Report,"
the other ordered in a gravelly voice. Doriana quickly and concisely summarized Palpatine's reluctant decision to let Sabaoth proceed with outbound flight, accompanied by as many Jedi as the Council felt appropriate.
"Excellent,"
Sidious said.
"It will be a distinct pleasure to get Jorah Sabaoth out of our way. All indeed goes according to my plan."
"Yes, my lord," Doriana said, although Palpatine wasn't certain the Senate would readily agree with him on outbound flight.
"I suspect he will think of something. Now listen closely. I want you to find a way to make yourself the Supreme Chancellor's personal liaison to outbound flight's final preparations."
"Easily done, my lord," Doriana assured him. "Palpatine is so tied up with other matters that he'll welcome the chance to pass this one on to my shoulders."
"Excellent,"
Sidious said.
"You have done well, my friend. Contact me when you have the position, and we'll discuss the final details."
The image vanished. Shutting off the holo projector, Doriana disconnected it from the computer and returned it to its hiding place. A simpler man, he reflected. Even a master of the dark side like Lord Tyrannus might have tried to eliminate Sabaoth directly through a genuine assassination, utilizing a more potent attack from more competent conspirators. But as Sidious himself had pointed out, Doriana was more subtle than that. After all, why simply dispose of a powerful troublemaker like Jorah Sabaoth when you could dispose of him and as many other Jedi as he could talk into accompanying him on outbound flight? Smiling to himself, Doriana began to disassemble his holoprojector. Jorah Sabaoth, Jedi Master, and potential threat to Darth Sidious's plan for the Republic, was dead. He just didn't know it yet. The door to the Jedi Council Chamber slid open. "Come," Jedi Master Mace Windu called. Squaring his shoulders, wondering what this was all about, Obi-Wan Kenobi stepped inside and stopped, feeling his forehead wrinkling in surprise. A person summoned to the Jedi Council Chamber naturally expected to find the entire Council waiting for him. But aside from Windu, standing over by the windows, gazing out at the city, the room was deserted.
"No, you haven't misunderstood where you were supposed to go," Windu said, half turning to give Obi-Wan a faint smile. "I need to talk to you."
"Certainly, Master Windu," Obi-Wan said, still frowning as he crossed to where Windu stood. "Is this about Anakin again?"
"No," Windu said. "Why? What's young Skywalker done now?"
"Nothing," Obi-Wan assured him hastily. "At least, nothing in particular. But you know what 14-year-old Padawan learners are like."
"Strong, cocky, and amazingly naive," Windu said, smiling again. "I wish you luck with him."
Obi-Wan shrugged. "If there is such a thing as luck."
"You know what I mean."
Windu turned back to look out the window.
"Tell me, have you ever heard of a project called Outbound Flight?"
Obi-Wan searched his memory. "I don't think so."
"It was proposed as a grand exploration and colonization mission," Windu said. 6 dreadnought warships were to be linked to each other around a central equipment and supply storage core. The whole thing to be sent out into the unknown regions, and from there to another galaxy."
Obi-Wan blinked. "To another galaxy? No, I haven't heard anything at all about this.
What's the proposed time frame?
Actually, it's mostly ready now, Windu said. Just the final assembly and some disagreements about the passenger list.
Who's in charge of it? The Senate?
Nominally. It was the Council's plan, Windu said. In practice, it's been Master Sabaoth who's been the chief driving force behind it.
Joris Sabaoth, master of the designated interview?
Obi-Wan asked dryly. And yet the project hasn't made HoloNet newscasts? Incredible. You shouldn't talk about a Jedi master that way.
Windu reproved him mildly. Am I wrong?
Windu shrugged, a slight lift of his shoulders. The fact is, everyone connected with Outbound Flight has had their reasons for keeping the project out of the public eye, he said. Chancellor Palpatine has been concerned that spending time and money this way in the face of the Republic's other problems might not go over very well. Ditto for the Senate, which provided the dreadnoughts they'll be using. He pursed his lips. As for the Council, we had reasons of our own.
Let me guess, Obi-Wan said. Sabaoth is hoping Outbound Flight can find out what happened to Vergere.
Windu looked at him in mild surprise. You are growing in Jedi insight, aren't you?
I'd like to think so, Obi-Wan said. But this doesn't really qualify. Anakin and I never did get the whole story of her disappearance. More to the point, we weren't able to find her on our last trip out that direction.
Never mind what Sabaoth wants. I want to know what happened to her. Careful, Obi-Wan, Windu warned. You mustn't allow your emotions to intrude on this.
Obi-Wan bowed his head. My apologies.
Emotion is the enemy. Windu went on. Emotion of all sorts. Yours and Master Sabaoth's.
Obi-Wan frowned. You think Master Sabaoth is getting too close to this project?
To be honest, I don't know what's happening with him. Windu admitted reluctantly. He insists that we need to send a strong force out into the unknown regions to find Vergere and bring her back, which is all well and good. But at the same time, he talks about how the Republic is teetering on the brink, and how it might be good to transfer some of the best Jedi out of the Republic entirely, settling them in new colonies in the unknown regions, where Coruscant politics can't touch them.
You're not really considering doing that, are you?
Obi-Wan asked. Windu turned to gaze out over the city. The Council has agreed to send 6 Jedi Masters on Outbound Flight, and 11 Jedi Knights have signed on to go along as well.
Obi-Wan grimaced. 6 Jedi Masters plus 11 Jedi Knights was not an insignificant number in these increasingly dark days.
Windu turned his unblinking gaze onto Obi-Wan. I want you and Anakin to find Sabaoth and ask to go along with him. Not all the way to the next galaxy, just through the unknown regions part of the exploration.
That could take months, Obi-Wan protested. I have work to do on Sulurine.
Sometimes a Jedi's most important duty is to stand and wait,
Windu countered mildly.
I presume you've mentioned that to Anakin on occasion?
Obi-Wan grimaced. Not more than twice a day, he conceded. Did you have any suggestions on how to convince Sabaoth to turn around when we reach the edge of the galaxy and take us back?
That would be an interesting conversation to sit in on, Windu said dryly. But no, my thought was to put a Delta 12 Sky Sprite aboard one of the dreadnoughts for you. It's a bigger, 2-seat version of the Delta 7 Aether Sprite you've been training on, only with the weapons pack stripped off. Kuat Systems is hoping to put them on the civilian market sometime in the next few months.
No internal hyperdrive, I take it.
Windu shook his head. It uses the same Transgal Meg hyperdrive ring as the Aether Sprite.
I don't know, Obi-Wan said doubtfully, running the numbers in his head. We're talking an awful lot of distance for something that size, especially with 2 people aboard.
It would be tight, but doable, Windu assured him, especially since both you and Anakin can use Jedi hibernation to stretch out the supplies of air and food.
Obi-Wan spread his hands. If that's what the Council wishes, Anakin and I stand ready to obey. If Sabaoth will have us, that is.
Just find a way aboard, Windu said, his eyes darkening. However you have to do it.
Thank you.
Thrawn had told Cardass that his base wasn't far from the spot where his task force had run into the Bargain Hunter. What he hadn't mentioned was that the trip would take nearly 3 standard days. About time. Kento muttered under his breath as the 3 humans stood together at the back of the Springhawks bridge and watched as the handful of ships flew in formation across a small asteroid field.
I'm about to go stir-crazy. You could always join Maris and me for the language lessons,
Cardass offered. Commander Thrawn really is decent company.
No thanks, Kento grunted. You two want to aid and abet a potential enemy, be my guests, not me.
These people are not potential enemies, Maris said firmly. As you'd realize, if you'd made any effort to get to know them, they're very polite and extremely civilized.
Yeah, well, the Hutts have a civilization too, or so they say,
Kento retorted.
Sorry, but it'll take more than good manners to convince me the Chiss are harmless.
Mentally, Cardass shook his head. Ever since that first night aboard when he'd been frozen out of the negotiations, Kento had been nursing a grudge against the Chiss in general, and Thrawn in particular. Thrawn had been across the bridge, standing beside the crewer at what Cardass had tentatively identified as the navigation station. Now the commander stepped back and circled to where the humans waited.
There,
he said, pointing ahead out the wide viewport. The large asteroid with the slow rotation. That's our base. Cardass frowned at it. The asteroid wasn't rotating so much as it was doing a slow wobble, nearly but not quite end over end. Not for pseudo-gravitational purposes, obviously. The Springhawk showed that the Chiss had artificial gravity. So why pick a rotating asteroid? Maris was obviously wondering the same thing. That wobble must make it hard to dock with, she commented.
It does require a certain degree of skill,
Thrawn agreed, lifting his eyebrows slightly, like a teacher trying to draw an answer from a group of students. Cardass looked back at the asteroid, and then suddenly he had it.
You've got a passive sensor array at one end. The wobble lets it sweep the whole sky instead of just one spot.
But why spin the whole asteroid?
Maris asked, sounding puzzled.
Couldn't you just rotate the array? Sure he could, Kento growled. But then there'd be something moving on the surface an enemy might spot. This way, everything's all nice and quiet and peaceful, right up to the minute when he blows their ships out from under them.
Essentially correct, Thrawn said. Though we're not expecting enemies to actually come calling. Still, it's wise to take precautions.
And they didn't blow our ship out from under us, Maris said, tapping a finger on Kento's chest for emphasis. Kento turned a glower toward her.
Cardass spoke up quickly.
So we're in Chiss space now?
Yes and no, Thrawn said. Currently there are only some survey and observation teams here, so it's hardly representative of a proper Chiss system. However, the second planet is quite habitable, and within a few years will probably be opened up to full colonization. At that point, it will come officially under the protection and control of the 9 ruling families.
I hope you're not expecting us to stay for opening ceremonies,
Kento muttered.
Of course not, Thrawn assured him. I tell you this simply because you might wish to return someday and see what we've made of the Krustai system.
You've named it already? Maris asked.
The initial survey team always has that honor, Thrawn said. In this case, the name Krustai is an acronym for
Krasisto Mith Ron Yurudo,
a Chiss called from across the bridge.
Risficatli Claristi Sufarin Risroka. Sakras Miso Ut Shisla,
Thrawn replied sharply, striding back to his command chair in the center of the bridge and sitting down.
Hosmik Faliar.
What did he say?
Kento demanded, grabbing at a nearby chair back for balance, as the Springhawk veered sharply portside and began to pick up speed.
What's going on?
I'm not sure,
Cardass said.
The only word roots I caught were the ones for stranger and run.
Stranger. Run.
Kento hissed between his teeth as the stars in the viewport stretched into starlines.
They're after someone.
Someone not too far away, either, Maris murmured. Isn't Sti a word root for near?
Yes, I think you're right,
Cardass agreed. For the next few minutes, the bridge crew worked busily at their stations, the silence punctuated only by an occasional command or comment. Less than a minute after entering hyperspace, they suddenly dropped back out again.
Already?
Kento muttered, sounding stunned.
He did a micro jump,
Cardass said, hardly believing it himself.
Ridiculous,
Kento insisted.
You can't hit the side of the Senate building with it.
Abruptly, the deck jerked beneath them, nearly knocking them off their feet. Reflexively, Cardass grabbed Maris's upper arm with one hand and a nearby conduit with the other, keeping both of them on their feet. Just as a pair of small ships roared past the viewport, spitting laser fire and missiles at the Springhawk.
I'd say we did a little better than hit the side of the Senate building,
Cardass managed as the deck again shook beneath them.
Looks like he's right where he wants to be.
Terrific, Kento bit out. I'm glad he wants to be here. The shaking subsided as the attackers flew out of optimum firing range, and Cardass focused on the visual displays. There were just three ships indicated, the two fighters now coming around for another pass, plus one larger ship considerably farther away. Unlike the fighters, the larger vessel seemed to be trying to move away from the battle zone instead of into it.
Here they come,
Kento said. Cardass looked back at the viewport. The Springhawk had swiveled to face its attackers, and in the distance he could see the glow as the fighters kicked their drives to full power.
Grab onto something, he warned.
The fighters split formation as they approached, veering toward opposite sides of their target, their lasers opening up again. The Springhawk's weapons returned fire, and both attackers exploded.
Whoa, Kento said. What in the...
They blew up, Maris breathed. A single shot, and they just blew up.
Don't start cheering just yet,
Cardass warned. The Springhawk was swinging away from the expanding clouds of debris and picking up speed.
There's still the big one left.
The dizzying sweep of stars settled down as they finished their turn, and in the distance, he could see the drive glow of the larger ship.
I don't suppose we could be lucky enough for it to be unarmed,
Kento said. Thrawn wouldn't attack an unarmed ship, Maris told him firmly.
Why not?
Kento growled back.
I would. Those fighters attacked first. That makes the whole bunch of them fair game.
And probably dead meat, Cardass muttered. Maris shivered but said nothing. The other ship saw them coming, of course. Even as the Springhawk closed to firing range, it swung partway around, and a handful of missiles streaked out. The Chiss lasers flashed in reply, and the missiles vaporized in mid-flight. The enemy responded by rolling 90 degrees over and launching a second salvo. This group, too, was dealt with at a safe distance. A third missile group followed, then a fourth, all destroyed en route.
Why don't they jump to light speed?
Maris murmured.
I don't think they can,
Cardass told her, pointing to one of the tactical displays. Looks to me like someone took out their hyperdrive.
When?
Kento asked, frowning.
I don't remember hearing any firing before the fighters attacked.
Someone had to be here to call in the news, Cardass reminded him.
Maybe he got in a lucky shot.
Whatever the reason, the other ship was definitely not getting away. The Springhawk continued to close the gap, and as they neared it, Cardass noticed for the first time that its hull was covered in what looked like ovoid bubbles, each roughly 2 meters across and 3 long.
What are those things?
Kento?
No idea,
the other said, craning his neck.
They look kind of like tiny observation blisters. Thought of the navigation system, maybe?
Or cabin viewports, Maris said. Could it be a passenger liner?
What, with 4 clusters of missile launchers?
Kento countered.
Not a chance.
The Chiss helmsman moved the Springhawk alongside the alien vessel, compensating almost casually for its sluggish attempts to veer away, and nestled up against the other's hull. There was a quick stutter of dull thuds as maglocks were engaged,
and Thrawn tapped a key on his command board.
Ch-Thra, he called.
Go, Cardass translated. Looks like we're boarding.
The commander rose from his chair and turned around. My apologies, he said, switching to Sibisti as he crossed to the three humans. I hadn't intended to take you into danger this way, but the opportunity presented itself, and I needed to take it.
Stepping to a bank of lockers along one wall, Thrawn opened one and pulled out an armored vac suit.
Your quarters are too close to the boarding area for safety, so I'll ask you to remain here until we return.
You're going in personally? Morris asked, frowning.
I command these warriors,
Thrawn said, climbing into the vac suit with sure, practiced movements. Part of my duty is to share in their danger.
Maris glanced at Kento. Be careful, she said, sounding almost embarrassed.
Thrawn gave her a small smile.
Don't worry, he said.
Slapping the final seal closed, he pulled a helmet and large handgun from the locker.
The vessel is most likely severely undercrewed, and Chiss warriors are the best there are. I'll return soon.
It took less than an hour for the Chiss to secure the enemy vessel. Another 2 hours went by, though, before one of the warriors came to the bridge with instructions to bring the humans aboard. Cardass hadn't traveled very much before hooking up with Kento and Maris, but most of his recent travel had been to the seedier parts of the Republic, and as he stepped into the boarding tunnel, he was confident he could handle anything they found at the other end. He was wrong. The vessel itself was bad enough. Dank and dirty, its entire interior showed signs of multiple repairs done in a hasty and careless manner, and the mixture of odors swirling through its corridors made his nose itch. Worst of all were the bodies. Cardass had seen bodies before, but only the serene and neatly laid out ones he'd encountered at funerals. Never before had he seen bodies haphazardly stretched out wherever the Chiss weapons had thrown them, twisted into whatever grotesque contortions their own death throes had sculpted for them. Ahead, a door opened, and Thrawn stepped into the corridor. He was still wearing his vac suit, but the helmet now hung on a fastener on his left hip.
Come, I want to show you something.
Taking a deep breath, focusing his attention on Thrawn's glowing eyes, Cardass managed to make it the rest of the way.
What are your thoughts?
Thrawn asked as they reached him, gesturing to the corridor around him.
I think they were probably very poor, Maris said, her tone mostly calm, but with an edge of disapproval. You can see where they've had to patch and repatch just to keep everything operating. This isn't a military ship, certainly not one that could have been a threat to the Chiss.
I agree. Thrawn agreed, turning his glowing eyes on her.
So, poor people, you think?
Nomads?
Or refugees? She said.
And the missiles?
They didn't do the passengers much good, did they?
No, but it wasn't for lack of trying. Thrawn turned to Kento. And you, Captain? What's your reading of this?
I don't know, Kento said calmly. And I don't especially care.
They fired first, right? Thrawn shrugged microscopically. Not entirely true. One of the sentries I had stationed here happened to be close enough as they came through to disable their hyperdrive. Cardass, your opinion?
Cardass looked around at the faded and motley walls. He looked behind him, locating the nearest alien body and doing a quick estimate of its height and reach.
Another look at the wall, and he turned back to Thrawn.
These aren't the ones who did the repairs, are they?
Very good, Thrawn said, smiling faintly. No, they aren't.
What do you mean? Kento asked, frowning.
These aliens are too tall, Cardass explained, pointing to the wall.
See here, where the sealant pattern changes texture? That's where whoever was slopping it on had to go get a ladder or float pad to finish the job.
And whoever that worker was, he was considerably shorter than the masters of this vessel.
Thrawn turned back to Maris. As you deduced, the vessel has indeed been repaired many times,
but not by its owners.
Maris's lips compressed into a hard, thin line, her eyes suddenly cold as she looked back at the dead bodies. They were slavers.
Indeed, Thrawn said. You of the Republic don't condone slavery yourselves, do you?
No, of course not, Maris assured him hastily. We have droids to handle most menial chores, Kardas added.
What are droids? Thrawn asked.
Mechanical workers that can think and act on their own, Kardas explained.
You must have something of the sort yourselves.
Actually, we don't, Thrawn said, eyeing Kardas thoughtfully.
Nor do any of the alien cultures we've met. Can you show me one?
Beside Maris, Kento rumbled warningly in his throat.
We didn't bring any on this trip, Kardas said, ignoring his captain's thunderous expression.
A pity, Thrawn said.
Still, if the Republic has no slavery, how is it you understand the concept?
Kardas grimaced. We do know a few cultures where it exists.
And your people permit this? The Republic hasn't got much pull with systems that aren't members.
Kento put in impatiently. Look, are we done here yet?
Not quite,
Thrawn said, gesturing toward the door he'd just come through.
Come and look.
More bodies? Steeling himself, determined not to go all woozy again, even if the whole place was piled high with them, Kardas stepped past the commander and through the doorway, and stopped short, his mouth dropping open in amazement. The room was unexpectedly large, with a high ceiling that must have stretched up at least two of the ship's decks. But it wasn't piled high with bodies. It was piled high with treasure. Treasure of all kinds, too. There were piles of metal ingots of various colors and sheens, neatly stacked inside acceleration webbing. There were rows of bins, some filled with coins or multicolored gems, others stocked with rectangular packages that might have been food or spices or electronics. Several heavy-looking cabinets against one wall probably held items that would have been too tempting to leave within easy reach of the slaves, or perhaps even the crew itself. There was also a good deal of artwork. Flats, sculpts, trestles, and other forms and styles Kardas couldn't even categorize. Most of it was stacked together, but he could see a few pieces scattered around throughout the room, as if some of the loaders either hadn't recognized them as art, or else hadn't much cared where they put them.
What in the worlds? Maris breathed.
A treasure vessel, carrying the plunder of many worlds, Thrawn said, slipping into the room behind them. They were not only slavers, but pirates and raiders as well. With an effort, Kardas pulled his eyes away from the treasure trove and focused on Thrawn.
You sound like you already know these people.
Only by reputation, Thrawn said. At least, up until now.
You've been hunting them?
A slight frown creased Thrawn's forehead.
Of course not. The Vagari have made no move against the Chiss Ascendancy. We therefore have no reason to hunt them. But you know their name.
Kento murmured.
As I said, I know their reputation, Thrawn said. They've been moving through this region of space for at least the past 10 years, preying mostly on the weak and the technologically primitive.
What about their slaves? Maris asked. Do you know anything about them?
Thrawn shook his head. We haven't found any aboard this vessel. From that and from this room, I presume they were en route to their main base.
And they offloaded the slaves to keep them from finding out where that base is? Kardas suggested.
Exactly, Thrawn said. The crew complement is smaller than one would expect for a vessel of this size as well. That indicates they weren't expecting trouble, but instead intended to go straight home.
Yes, you mentioned back on the bridge that they were undercrewed, Kardas said. How did you know that?
I deduced it from the fact that their defense was sluggish and mostly ineffectual, Thrawn said.
So what happens now? Maris asked.
I'll have the vessel towed back to Krustai for further study,
Thrawn said, giving the room one last look before turning back to the door.
Question, Kento put in. You told Cardass you'd be giving us some extra stuff as payment for teaching you basic, right?
That wasn't precisely the way I stated it, Thrawn said. But that's essentially correct. And the longer we stay, the more extras we get.
Thrawn smiled faintly. That may be possible. I thought you were in a rush to return home.
No, no, there's no hurry, Kento assured him, giving the treasure room a leisurely sweep of his eyes.
No hurry at all.
Cardass had noted on their first approach to Thrawn's asteroid that the base itself seemed remarkably well hidden. It was only as they approached now for the second time that he found out how the commander had pulled off that particular trick. Instead of being built on the surface, the base was inside. Inside, in fact, down a long twisting tunnel, a path the Springhawk's helmsman took at a far better clip than was actually necessary.
Impressive place,
Cardass said aloud, trying to cover his nervousness as he watched the rocky walls shooting past.
Is this typical Chiss construction?
Not at all, Thrawn said, his voice sounding odd as he gazed out the bridge viewport. Most bases are on the surface. I wanted this one to be more difficult for potential enemies to penetrate.
Interesting.
What? Cardass asked.
That pattern of colored lights woven between the approach markers,
Thrawn said, pointing to the wall just ahead.
It indicates the presence of visitors.
Is that good or bad? Maris asked.
Thrawn shrugged. That depends on who the visitors are.
3 minutes later, they came around a final curve, and the tunnel opened up into a large cavern. At the far side, the rock face was alive with the glinting lights of ranging markers and viewports, with 8 ships nestled up against various docking stations. 5 were the Chiss fighters Cardass had already seen in action. 2 were small transport-style shuttles, and the 8th was a cruiser about the size of the Springhawk.
Ah, Thrawn said. Our guests are from the 5th ruling family.
How can you tell? Maris asked.
By the design and markings of the spacecraft, Thrawn said.
I can also tell that the visitor is of direct but peripheral family lineage.
So is that good or bad? Cardass asked.
Mostly neutral, Thrawn said. The 5th family has interests in this region, so this is most likely a routine survey. Certainly someone of higher rank, and from the 1st or 8th families, would have come to deliver a reprimand.
Cardass frowned sideways at Maris.
A reprimand? You'll all be my guests at the welcoming ceremony, of course.
Thrawn continued as the Springhawk made its way toward an empty docking station.
You may find it interesting.
Interesting, in Cardass's opinion, was far too mild a word. To begin with, there was the welcoming chamber itself. At first, it appeared to be nothing more than an empty, unadorned gray room just off the docking station. But at a touch of a hidden button, all that changed. Colorful panels folded out from the walls, reversing and settling themselves flat again. A handful of draperies descended from hidden panels in the ceiling, along with wavy, stalactite-like formations that reminded Cardass of frozen pieces of Aurora Borealis skyfire. The floor tiles didn't flip or reconfigure, but intricate patterns of colored lights appeared through a transparent outer surface, some of them remaining stationary or slowly pulsing, while others ran sequences that gave the illusion of flowing rivers. Every color of the spectrum was represented, but yellow was definitely favored. It was an impressive display, and the Chiss who stepped through the portal a minute later was no less impressive. He strode in, flanked by a pair of young Chiss wearing dark yellow uniforms and belted handguns. His own outfit, consisting of an elaborately layered gray robe with a yellow collar and generous yellow highlights. Thrawn's greeting and the visitor's response were in Chiyun, of course.
and once again, Cardass was only able to catch occasional words. But the tone and flow of the speeches, along with the equally formalized gestures and movements, had a sense of ancient ritual that he found fascinating. The ceremony ended. The two yellow-clad chiss moved back to flank the doorway to the ship, and with a gesture, Thrawn led his visitor to where the three humans waited.
"May I present Aristokra Chaff Form Bintranu of the fifth ruling family," he said, switching from Chiyun to Sibisti. "These are Corellan traders, visitors from a far world." Chaff Form Bintranu said something, his tone rather sharp. "In Sibisti, Aristokra, if you please," Thrawn said. "They do not understand Chiyun."
Chaff Form Bintranu snorted, again in Chiyun, and the corners of Thrawn's mouth tightened briefly.
"Aristokra Chaff Form Bintranu is not interested in communicating with you at present,"
he translated.
"One of my warriors will show you to your quarters."
His eyes flicked to Cardass.
"My apologies."
No apologies needed, Commander, Cardass assured him, feeling a tightness in his throat as he gave Chaff Form Bintranu an abbreviated bow. "None at all." The rooms Thrawn had ordered for them were built along the same lines as their quarters aboard the Springhawk, though somewhat larger. There were also two sleeping rooms this time instead of one, with a common refresher station set between them. Kento and Maris were shown to one of the rooms, while Cardass was taken to the other. Exploring his new quarters, Cardass discovered, to his mild surprise, that his clothing and personal effects had already been brought from his cabin on the Bargain Hunter and arranged neatly in the various storage drawers. Apparently, Thrawn was planning an extended stay for them. Cardass paced the floor for a while, trying not to think about Chaff Form Bintranu and his unconcealed disapproval of their presence in Chiss territory. An hour later, a silent warrior arrived at his door with a meal on a tray. It was 5 hours later, and he was dozing at the computer station when another Chiss finally came to fetch him. He was taken to a darkened room that was a close double of the Springhawk's forward visual triangulation site.
"Good evening, Cardass," Thrawn said from one of the seats to the side of the room. "I trust you had a productive day." "Reasonably productive, yes," Cardass said, going over and sitting down beside him. "I wanted to apologize to you for Aristokra Chaff Form Bintranu's lack of courtesy." "I'm sorry he took a dislike to us," Cardass said. "It was nothing personal," Thrawn assured him. "Aristokra Chaff Form Bintranu considers your presence here a threat to the Ascendancy."
"May I ask why?" Thrawn shrugged fractionally.
"To some people, the unknown always represents a threat."
"Sometimes they're right," Cardass conceded. "On the other hand, you Chiss seem quite capable of taking care of yourselves in a fight."
"Perhaps," Thrawn said. "There are times when I wonder. Tell me, do you understand the concept of neutralizing a potential enemy before that enemy can launch an attack against you?"
"You mean like a preemptive strike?" Cardass asked.
"Certainly." "It's widespread among your people, then?"
"I'm not sure widespread is the right word," Cardass hedged. "I know there are people who consider it immoral."
"Do you?"
Cardass grimaced. He was 23 years old, and he worked for a smuggler who liked to tweak huts. What did he know about the universe?
"I think that if you're going to do something like that, you need to make very sure they're a genuine threat," he said slowly. "I mean, you need to have evidence that they were actually planning to attack you."
"What about someone who may not plan to attack you personally, but is constantly attacking others?" It was pretty obvious where this was going.
"You mean like the Vagari?" Cardass asked.
"Exactly," Thrawn confirmed. "As I told you, they have not yet attacked Chiss territory,
and military doctrine dictates that they must therefore be ignored. Do the beings they prey on have any claim on our military strength, or must we simply stand aside and watch as they are slaughtered or enslaved? Kardash shook his head. You're asking questions that have been argued since civilization began. He stole a look at the commander's profile. I take it you and Aristokra Chaform Bintrano disagree on this point.
I and the entire Chiss species disagree on this point, Thrawn said, a note of sadness in his voice.
Did you tell the Aristokra about the Vagari ship? Kardas asked.
I did, and he wasn't particularly impressed, Thrawn said. For him, the defensive-only doctrine admits to no exceptions.
What if some of those victims were species you know? Kardas suggested. Friends, or even just trading partners. Would that make a difference?
I doubt it, Thrawn said thoughtfully.
We do little trading outside our borders.
Still, it might be useful to examine the treasure in detail.
He cocked his head.
Would you be interested in assisting?
Of course, Kardas said, though I don't know what help I would be.
You might recognize some of the artifacts, Thrawn said, standing up. If they also prey on worlds of your republic, you may have additional data that would be useful.
In that case, you should also invite Maris and Kento along, Kardas said, standing up as well. They've traveled a lot more than I have. The Vagari ship had been anchored to the outside of the Krustai asteroid base, a quarter of the circumference around from the entrance tunnel. With the Chiss warrior at the controls, Thrawn and the three humans took one of the transports out from the base and docked with it. To Kardas's private dismay, the alien bodies were still there, lying crumpled right where they'd fallen. Kenta was apparently not thrilled by that fact either.
You are planning to clean up this place eventually, aren't you?
He asked distastefully as they picked their way through the corridor toward the treasure room.
Eventually, Thrawn assured him.
First, we need to learn what we can of the enemy's strategy and tactics. And for that, we need to know where each combatant was and how he was positioned when he died.
Shouldn't you have put the ship somewhere out of sight?
Maris asked.
Eventually, we'll move it inside the base, Thrawn said. But we need to first establish that there are no dangerous instabilities in its engines or weaponry.
The treasure room, like the corridors, looked exactly the same as it had just after the ship's capture, except that now there were a pair of Chiss moving along the stacks, apparently making sensor records of the various items.
Spread out, Thrawn ordered the humans. See if you can find anything of a familiar style.
You mean like different kinds of money?
Kento asked as he looked around the room.
Or are you talking about the gemstones?
Maris added.
I was speaking mainly of the artwork, Thrawn said. We can learn more from that than we can from currency or gems.
Kento snorted.
You expecting there to be sales receipts?
I was thinking more of the art's origins.
Thrawn gestured toward a set of nested trestles.
Those, for instance, were probably created by beings with an extra joint between wrist and elbow, who see largely in the blue ultraviolet part of the spectrum.
Kento and Maris exchanged looks.
The Frunchies, you think? Maris suggested. Yeah, right,
Kento said with a grunt.
What are Frunchies?
Kardas asked.
The Franchettan Psi, Maris explained. They have a couple of colony worlds in the Outer Rim.
Rack calls them Frunchies because I'll be broggled,
Kento said, cutting her off as he leaned over the trestles with his head cocked to the side.
What?
Maris said.
He's right,
Kento said, sounding stunned.
It's signed with formal Frunchie script.
He turned back to Thrawn, a strange expression on his face.
I thought you said you hadn't made it to Republic space.
To the best of my knowledge, we haven't,
Thrawn said.
But the artist's physical characteristics are obvious simply from looking at his work. Maybe to you it's obvious,
Kento growled, looking back at the trestles.
Maybe it was just luck, Kento said, abandoning the trestles and kneeling down beside an elaborate blue and white sculpt. Let me see here. Yeah, I thought so. He looked over his shoulder at Thrawn. How about this one? For a moment, Thrawn studied the sculpt in silence, his eyes occasionally flicking around the rest of the room as if seeking inspiration. The artist is humanoid, he said at last, proportioned differently from humans and Chiss, with either a wider torso or longer arms. There's something of a distance to his emotional state, too. I would say his people are both drawn to and yet repulsed by or fearful of the physical objects they live among. Kento's breath went out in a huff. I don't believe this. That's the Pashvi, all right. I don't think I know them, Maris said. They've got a system on the edge of wild space, Kento said. I've been there a few times. There's a small but stable market for their art, mostly in the corporate sector. What did Commander Thrawn mean about fear of physical objects? Kardas asked. Their world is sprinkled with thousands of rock pillars, Kento said. Most of the best food plants grow on the tops. Unfortunately, so does a nasty predator avian. It makes for, well, for pretty much just what he said. And you got all that from a single sculpt? Maris asked, gazing at Thrawn with a strange look on her face. Actually, no, the Chiss assured her. There are, let me see, 12 more examples of their artwork. He pointed to 2 other areas of the room. You sure? Kardas asked, frowning at the indicated sculpts and flats. They don't look at all alike to me. They were created by different artists, Thrawn said, but the species is the same. This is really weird, Kento said, shaking his head. Like some crazy Jedi thing. Jedi? Thrawn asked. They're the guardians of the peace in the Republic, Maris told him. Probably the only reason we've held together as long as we have. They're very powerful, very noble people. They sound intriguing. Thrawn nodded toward the sculpt. I presume these Pashvi won't have put up much resistance to Vagari raids? Hardly, Kento confirmed grimly. They're a pretty agreeable people, lousy at fighting. And your Republic and these Jedi don't protect them. The Jedi are spread way too thin, Kardas said. Anyway, wild space isn't actually part of the Republic. Even if it were, the government is too busy with its own intrigues to bother with little things like life and death situations, Maris said. I see, Thrawn said. Well, let us continue our survey, and please inform me if you find anything else from your region of space. He looked at Maris. And as we search, perhaps you'll tell me more about these Jedi.
It had been a long, frustrating day at the Preparation Center. One more of an endless series of them stretching back to the beginning of time. And as Chaz Ulyar keyed open his apartment door, he wondered yet again if all of this was ever going to be worth it. The glow plates in the common room were off, but as he switched them on, he spotted a sliver of light coming from beneath the doors of both sleeping rooms. At least 2 of his 3 roommates were home then. He was looking through the pantry, trying to decide what to have for dinner, when one of the doors opened behind him. Hey, Chaz! Brace Tarkosa called from behind him. You hear the news? Ulyar shook his head. I've been on D5 all day trying to run down a fuel line problem, he said, turning around. Let me guess. The Senate's decided to close us down completely?
You've got it backward,
Tarkosa said, grinning. He was a strongly built man, 2 years older than Ulyar, and allegedly one of the first 100 people to have signed up with the project. Not only are they not closing us down, they've restored full funding and authorized the final assembly of the dreadnoughts and reversed themselves on dropping the families. Ulyar stared at him. You're kidding. Did someone on Coruscant have spoiled shellfish for lunch and start hearing voices? Tarkosa shook his head.
Rumor has it that it's all Jedi Master Sabaoth's doing. And it looks like we're gonna get some more Jedi, too.
How many?
Don't know, Tarkosa said. As many as Sabaoth.